Tonight we're going to be looking at a subject, the subject of divorce. It's a subject that is not a very pleasant subject, and one that is somewhat painful to some of you. And because of that, I want to begin the message tonight by singing you a little song. And I want you to think very carefully about the words of the song. The song is called Forgiven, and it's an important one for us to remember. The Lord is always good to me and ready to forgive. He's plenteous in mercy when I confess to Him. He's faithful to forgive me and to make me right again by washing my iniquity and cleansing me from sin. And by the holy word of God, I clearly came to know God purged me with His hyssop and washed me white as snow. From east to west, my sins are gone. From guilt, God set me free. He buried my iniquity deep down in the sea. That's a good song for us to remember. God has forgiven us. If we have confessed our sin to Him, God has forgiven us. And when God forgives us, He buries it in the depths of the deepest sea. And we need to accept His forgiveness and remember that. So as we look at the passage here tonight, let's learn some things. You know, I've told you this before, but it's important for us to remember. One of the best things we can learn from history is to learn from history. And there was the examples of the people of Israel, the mistakes that they did. And if we can learn from their mistakes, we can gain helpful information that will help us avoid the same mistakes they made. And so tonight, as we look at this passage, I'm not going to read all of it. There's a lot of verses here. We're going to be looking at chapters 9 and 10. I thought about bringing my recorder or my player and just play it all for you, but it'd take quite a few minutes to do that. Decided not to do that. But as we look at this here tonight, we'll read some of the verses that will get us started here, and it'll help us to understand what was taking place. So let's start out with Ezra chapter 9, read the first couple verses. It says, "Now when these things were done, the princes came to me saying, 'The people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the people of the land, doing according to the abominations of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Ammonites. For they have taken their daughters for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy seed have mingled themselves with the people of those lands. Yea, the hand of the priests... or the hand of the princes and the rulers have been chief in this trespass. And when I heard this thing, I rent my garment and my mantle and plucked off the hair of my head and of my beard and sat down astonished. And then were assembled unto me every one that trembled at the words of God of Israel, because of the transgression of those that had been carried away, and I sat astonished until the evening sacrifice." Here's the situation. Ezra had gone back to Israel. They had built the temple 50-some years earlier. They had had 50 years now of settling into the land. They've gotten back into the routine of things. And they began to do what God had told them not to do years and years before. God told them not to intermarry with the heathen. Do not marry an unbeliever. It will pull you down. It'll destroy you. And they started doing the same thing again. Now, that was the very sin that had taken them into captivity to begin with. That's one of the main reasons they went to captivity before, is because they had intermarried with the people and were living in ungodly lives. They had brought their sinfulness into their lives. They started worshiping their idols. That's what Solomon did when he married all these pagan wives. He started building altars for them and temples for them, and it corrupted the nation, and the whole nation turned against God, and they began worshiping all these wicked idols. And that's what took them into captivity for. Now Ezra comes back, finds this problem that was developing or had developed over these last 50 years, and his heart was just crushed. He couldn't believe this was happening, and he could foresee what was going to happen if something didn't stop it immediately. It was going to go right down the same road as it went before, and the people were going to go right back into captivity, and the nation was going to be destroyed. And this grieved his heart, and so therefore he called the people together, and he sat there astonished and just overwhelmed by these problems. Now, what I want us to look at here tonight is the problem and then the solution, and then the application. We're going to spend most of our time on the application, but a little bit of time on the other two here that will help us to understand. And I urge you to read through the section. There's some portions of the section that has a lot of names in it, but a lot of it doesn't, and you can do that later on. But he's troubled over their mixed marriages. Now, that term, mixed marriages, it refers to the marriage of an unbeliever with a believer. An unbeliever with a believer, a mixed marriage. It was unequally yoked. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse number 3, God had told them, "Neither shalt thou make marriages with them. Thy daughters shalt thou shalt not give to unto their sons, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son." So God said, do not intermarry with the people that you are around. Don't do that. And mixed marriages, they cause a disloyalty, a conflicting of loyalties. You can see the believer wants to do it God's way. The unbeliever wants to do it their way. That's what Solomon ran into when he started marrying all these pagan wives. The wife, you know, she come crying on his shoulder, praying, "Oh, Solomon, I want to worship my gods. Please build me an altar." And so what's Solomon do? He finally caved in, built them altars, built them temples for all their pagan gods. And those things that Solomon built continued on for the next centuries and destroyed and ruined the nation. And it was Solomon's fault. But it wasn't always just Solomon. It would actually, it probably happened before that too. But Solomon was a main contributor to these things. And so Ezra could see the same thing happening. Now, why is it so important that we understand the criticalness of a believer not marrying an unbeliever? Well, first of all, the scripture tells us clearly that we shouldn't do that. Over in 2 Corinthians, it talks about that. We'll see that later. But a story that I read number of years ago that it pitches this very well. And it was a teenage girl that liked an unsaved boy. And her parents forbid her to date him and spend time with him because he was unsaved. You got to have a Christian. So she finally talked him into coming to church. He came to church, made a profession of salvation, and then the parents said, okay, he's a Christian now. You can spend time with him. And she spent time with him, started dating him, and they ended up getting married. As they're pulling out of the church parking lot of their marriage, he says, "Whew, glad that's over. Never have to go back to that church again." She says, "What do you mean?" He says, "I was just putting that all on so I could marry you. I don't want to go to that church. I want nothing to do with it." And she was heartbroken. But it was too late. She was married. Now, her parents weren't very wise. At least they were wise enough to say, no, you're not going to date an unsaved man. But they weren't very wise in their discretion of the whole situation either. And it led to heartbreak. And it led to a very sad life for that young lady. Now, God was greatly offended by the people's actions. God did not want them intermarrying. He said, do not do that. Because he knew that it would pull them away. He knew it would destroy them. And this is what had happened before, and now Ezra sees it happen right amongst their own people there, and he was broken over this, and he was grieved over this. And God graciously had saved us, or spared a remnant of the people. What do we mean by a remnant? A little portion, a little piece of the people. You know, you think about the thousands of Israel. You know, when David was king, and they had thousands and thousands of people in their army, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in their army. And then when they came back from captivity? A little handful. About 50,000 or something like that. That's all that was left. They had been destroyed, but God saved a little remnant. He saved a few of them because God did not want to destroy them completely. And in chapter 9 and verse number 8, Ezra is praying here. He says, "Now for a little space, grace hath been showed from the Lord our God to leave us a remnant to escape, and to give us a nail in his holy place." He calls that little remnant a nail in his holy place. Just as one little peg in the wall. That's all we are. I mean, we used to be the nation, but now we're just a nail in God's little holy place. And yet God spared them and had mercy upon them. And they were then again abusing the grace of God. God had given mercy. God had brought them back. God had given back their nation again. God had mercy upon the nation of Israel. And now they're doing the same thing again that they had gotten in trouble for before. And it destroyed their nation. They hadn't learned. Now, as we think about this, we need to remember, when we see something happen in the life of someone else or we've gone through something, God doesn't want us to go and do it again. You know, the scriptures talk about a bad habit a dog has. He talks about the dog returning to their vomit. Now, that's a disgusting habit a dog has. But you know, many times we're just as disgusting as the dogs are. We do something wrong, and we get it right, and then before long, what do? Go right back to it again. God says, that's wrong. That's not right. That we shouldn't do that. We need to stay away from it. So God is just encouraging us to leave these things and get away from it. And so here was the problem. The people had been intermarrying, and their lives were being headed the wrong direction again. The solution. What was he to do to fix the problem? Well, this is interesting what he has to say here, and it's good that we take a careful look at it and you listen carefully so we understand what was taking place. Ezra's heart was broken, and this sparked a revival amongst the people. In verse number 1 of chapter 10, it said, Now when Ezra had prayed, and when he had confessed, weeping and casting himself down before the house of God, there assembled unto him out of Israel a very great congregation of men and women and children, for the people wept very sore. All right? Ezra got right with God. What happened? It sparked a revival, and the people got right with God, and they came and they were weeping before him and said, we were wrong. We shouldn't have done this. This wasn't right. And they're getting right with God. And revival always begins with one person truly getting right with God and then beginning to pray for revival. R.A. Torrey, a preacher of years gone by, made this statement. He said, I can give a prescription that will bring revival. Revival in any church or community or any city on earth. First, let a few Christians get thoroughly right with God. If this is not done, the rest will come to nothing. Second, let them bind themselves together to pray for revival until God opens the windows of heaven and comes down. Third, let them put themselves at the disposal of God for his use as he sees fit in winning others to Christ. That is all. He said that will bring revival. And that's really what we saw here. Ezra gets right with God. He just pours his heart out. And it wasn't really even Ezra's fault, technically. He hadn't intermarried. He hadn't done the wrong, but his people had. And so he gets on his knees and he pours his heart out to God and he prays and he gets right with God and he confesses the sins of the nation. And the people, God's Spirit began to work in their hearts, and they got on their knees before the Lord and were crying sore and very burdened over the problem that had taken place. And so a revival was begun. And then they forsook their sins, and by doing so, it offered them hope again. Verse number 9. I wrote the wrong scripture down here. But if we fit this into the context here of Ezra 9 and 10, we see here what was taking place. All right, the Jews were God's people. Why was it important? Why was it important? Think with me. Why was it important for the Jews to maintain their purity? It was because of the coming of the Messiah. God's plan was that his people, the Jews, would be the nation and the people through whom his son would come to this earth and bring redemption and forgiveness of sin to all mankind. And so it was important that they did not corrupt their nation and lose their identity and and God send them off into destruction because of their wickedness. It was important that they stayed loyal and pure and true to God. And so it was because of this that the conclusion was made here as they did. And we'll see it in just a moment. And one of the things to remember is we don't fit into the same category as the people did in Ezra's day. Right, we are not Jews, for one thing, and we are not preserving the line of the Messiah. All right, we're not waiting for the Messiah to come through us. And so we are not in the same category that they were in. Now, what exactly took place here? Well, Ezra says to them, he says, we need to break off these marriages. All right, in verse number 3 of chapter 10. Now, therefore, let us make a covenant with our God to put away all the wives and such as are born of them, according to the counsel of the Lord, and of those that tremble at the commandment of our God, and let it be done according to the law. Now, we look at that and we think, whoa, why would they do that? You know, they're putting away all their wives, and even if they have children, they're not going to be married to them anymore. All right? Now, God doesn't tell us what happened as far as did the men continue to provide for the women that they had been married for, even though they're not married anymore. We don't know those details. All we know is that God says that the marriages have to be broken off because of the purity of the Jewish line that was needful to be maintained. Now, that was a special, unique situation in the time of Ezra. That does not give us then, and I'll show you in just a few moments, that does not give us the right to apply that to today and say, all right, if you're a Christian and you're married to an unsaved person, then you can divorce them and go on with life. It doesn't say that, because it was a special situation for a unique situation. All right, now, in Jesus' ministry, he boldly spoke out against divorce. And he limited divorce to engagement. All right, and I'll show you that in just a moment here, that Jesus limited the divorce to engagement. Now, I want you to look up some of these verses with me. Turn to Matthew chapter 19. Matthew chapter 19, I want you to see these good verses to mark down so you know and understand, because this is one of those times when we can't be ruled by our emotions. We need to be ruled by the Scriptures and not by our emotions, because our emotions, and I'll tell you, even my emotions, I feel sorry for people that are stuck in situations that aren't good, and my emotions want to go the wrong direction. Matthew chapter 19, and we're going to be looking at verse number 9. And before we read the verse, make sure you understand, identify the words in it. He talks about fornication and he talks about adultery in the same verse. If he's talking about them in the same verse, the fornication refers to that which immorality before marriage, and adultery is immorality after or during marriage. All right? And I know that some people would say, no, the word fornication, there is a general one that can mean anything. Well, it is. But at the same time, in the context, that's not how Jesus used it. All right? He used it specifically separated. All right? Look at the verse. It says, "And I say unto you," Jesus speaking, "whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. And whosoever marries her that is put away doth commit adultery." All right, so he says here, except for fornication. So, if he's saying, if a person put away his wife for fornication, then there was no problem. But if they put him away for any other reason besides fornication, then they were committing adultery. So what was the situation? What's taking place here? Fornication was before marriage. All right, so if it was a situation where two young people were not married yet, just like, remember Joseph and Mary, when they were engaged, and then Mary comes to tell Joseph, "I'm going to be having a baby," and he says, "Hang on now, that's not my baby. What's going on?" "Oh, an angel put him in." "Yeah, sure." And then God gave him the information from the angel that it really was an angel. But prior to that, just before the angel came and told Joseph that she was telling him the truth, what did Joseph plan to do? Put her away privately. All right, so he says, "I don't want to kill her. I don't want to have her stoned to death. I'm going to put her away privately." And he had the right to do that during engagement. All right? And yet, if it was after they were married, then they had already consummated their marriage, and then there would have been adultery involved. It wouldn't have been fornication. So Jesus was speaking of engagement. Now, to help us to make sure we understand this, Jesus reinforced the original marriage vows. In verse number 5 to 8 of Matthew 19, he says there, "And said, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. Wherefore they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. They say unto him, why did Moses then command to give a writing of divorcement, and to put her away? And he saith unto them, Moses, because of the hardness of your heart, suffered you, or allowed you, to put away your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so." So Jesus said, listen, we need to go back to what God had in the beginning. In the beginning, God says, "I want one man for one woman, and that's for life." That was God's plan from the beginning. Divorce was not part of his plan from the very beginning. Now, Jesus, in the book of Mark, all right, now remember, think with me again when we studied through the books of the Bible. All right, Mark was written to who? Mark was written to the Gentiles. Matthew was written to the Jews. That's why Matthew is the only place in the Bible where he talks about the exception. Because the Jews had a custom that engagement was extremely binding. It was as binding as marriage. The only thing was that they couldn't consummate their marriage until their wedding day. But when the parents of the young man and woman got together and said, "All right, our daughter's going to marry your son," and they signed the papers and did whatever they did, they were married as far as the law said. But they didn't consummate the marriage until the wedding day. And so during the time between the binding of that engagement and the day they got married, that was a period of time where they were considered married by law, but they were not married in a physical sense. They could not come together until their marriage day. And it was during that time, that period, where Joseph and Mary were found. And it was during that time when Jesus said that there could be that exception of the divorce, if there was one of them had been immoral during that time. But Mark, when he addresses it, he says in Mark chapter 10, verse number 11, that the parallel passage, and Mark never mentions the exception in this because he's writing to the Gentiles, and they didn't have that rule. He says there in Mark 10, verse 11, "And he said unto them, Whosoever shall put away his wife and marry another committeth adultery against her. And if a woman shall put away her husband and be married to another, she committeth adultery." All right? So there's no exception here because he was writing to the Gentiles, not to the Jews. Now, even in cases of unfaithfulness, forgiveness and restoration are God's solution, not divorce. Now, our emotions sometimes get a hold of us and we feel like, "Oh boy, that just doesn't seem right." And oh, if God really understood their situation and how bad she was treated or whatever happened and how wicked that was, and, you know, God would make exceptions for us. Well, all I can tell you is, even though my emotions go that way too, we got to stick with what the Bible said. And the Bible said that there was no exception. Jesus said that they were not to do that. Now, Paul addressed it as well. You know, he was addressing it to Gentiles. And he addressed it both in Romans 7, verses 2 and 3, and also in 1 Corinthians 7. Let's turn over to the 1 Corinthians 7. I want to show you some things there. 1 Corinthians 7. And let me show you a couple of things from the verses here. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And verses 10 and 11. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 10 and 11. "And unto the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord, let not the wife depart from her husband. But if she depart, let her remain unmarried, and be reconciled to her husband, and let not the husband put away his wife." All right, so if she left him because he was hurting her or abusing her in some way or had been unfaithful, he says she is to remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband, but not to divorce. And he was not to put away his wife. He was not to divorce his wife. That was God's rule there. Now, we find, as you read down further, in verse number 39 of the same chapter, verse number 39, "The wife is bound by the law as long as her husband liveth. But if her husband be dead, she is at liberty to marry to whom she will, only in the Lord." The word "bound" there is a word that means to be fastened with chains or under obligation or under duty. She's bound to the law, to her husband, as long as her husband lives. As long as he's alive, she was not able to marry anyone else. And she was to be bound to her husband. She was married to him. And once he's dead, then she has the liberty to marry to whom she will, only in the Lord. It's important we see those last words are "only in the Lord." That was a significant part of it. Then also turn back a little bit to verse number 14. And some people take this verse and misunderstand this one as well. It says in verse 14, "For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Else were the children unclean, but now they are holy." Right? Now, he's talking about a woman that is married to an unsaved person. He says that he is sanctified by her, that relationship. And he says to the Christian man that married to an unsaved woman, you know, maybe they got saved. He wasn't saying, it doesn't matter how the situation came about, but he says then she's sanctified by him. What does it mean by sanctified? Well, the word sanctified means to be made holy, but it certainly is not talking about being saved. Salvation is not by my spouse. doing something for me. Salvation is by faith in Christ alone, nothing else. So he's not talking about saving faith here. So there had to be something else there that he was talking about, that there would be a special something in protecting those children because of the unbelieving one and being sanctified by the believer. And there's lots more into that, and we don't have the time to dig in deep into that passage there. But the biggest thing I want us to see from this is that sanctified there doesn't mean that the unsaved one gets saved because he's married to a Christian, because that doesn't even make sense. So what are you supposed to do in a situation like that? Well, Peter addresses that in 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. 1 Peter 3, 1 and 2, Peter addresses and says, what do you do if your situation is such that you've got an unbelieving husband? What do you do? Well, 1 Peter 3 and verse 1 says, likewise, you wives, be in subjection to your own husband, that if any obey not the word, right, that sounds, it could be a carnal Christian, but it certainly could be an unsaved man. If they obey not the word, they also may, without the word, be won by the conversation of the wives while they behold your chaste conversation coupled with fear. He said you need to live a godly, good, wholesome life before them, as a testimony to them, so that they would see their need for coming to Christ. And so that was God's solution to those difficult situations. And Christians who Christians are to marry only Christians. All right, God makes that clear. 2 Corinthians chapter 6 says not to be unequally yoked with an unbeliever. To be unequally yoked with an unbeliever, it doesn't matter how nice of a person they are. Don't do it. You know, you young people, you need to really remember this. Don't, no matter what your feelings are, he's such a nice guy or she's such a pretty girl. Doesn't make any difference if they're not a genuine believer. And, you know, I think that a wise Christian would go a step further than that. Not just a genuine believer, but one who loves the Lord and is walking with the Lord. I mean, just because they say, just like that illustration they gave in the first, that guy said, oh yeah, I'm a Christian now. But he was a fake. And her parents should have been wise enough to figure this out. This guy really doesn't look like he's a Christian. He doesn't act like a Christian, but he says he is. And he came to church, and he comes to church and, you know, does all the things we're supposed to do. So I guess he must be, and so it's okay. No, it still was harmful, and he was a fake in that situation. But, you know, what we need is we need, for our, as parents, we need to help our children find godly spouses. Spouses that love the Lord, not just our call themselves a Christian, but they truly love the Lord so that they will go on to have a happy and a fulfilling marriage. And so this is true with when a person remarries after their spouse dies. We saw that in 1 Corinthians 9:39, or when a young person marries for the first time, to marry a Christian only. And so the biggest thing to remember, you know, even in friendships, you know, sometimes young people think, well, I'm not planning to marry them, they're just my friend. Well, yeah, friendships turn into marriage, right? That's how it all happens. You know, they're friends, and then we're good friends, and then we're really good friends, and then, I want to marry them now. Well, hang on now. But then, then they're already so attached that it's like, oh, Mom and Dad, you're being mean, and then they run off and do it and marry it anyway. All right? So we need to just say right from the beginning, no, we're not going to. And, you know, dating's another situation, another topic altogether. I really don't believe that dating is a biblical proposition. Courtship is much more biblical. The difference between dating and courtship is dating is the young people can go off together in the car and drive off and, oh, I'm just taking her home. Yeah, well, that's not safe. That's not good. That's not wise. That's dating, being all by themselves together. Courtship is where Mom and Dad are overseeing the relationship. And the young people are never, ever left alone. And you say, oh, come on, Pastor. They're big kids now. No, we got sinful flesh. All right? And they can sit on the other side of the room and talk and fellowship. And I don't have to sit there and listen to every word they say. But to leave them all by themselves and go away and let them do their own thing, that's just asking for trouble. That's foolish. That's not right. And so we dare not do that. Dating is not a biblical thing. Courtship is much more biblical, where the parents are directly involved. I'm not saying that parents got to go and say, all right, son, here, I found your wife for you. But they don't like her. Too bad, I picked her for you. And I'm not saying we got to do that. But I think that we should be, that's why if you start when the kids are young and you have a good relationship with them so that they trust you and you trust them and you work together, by the time they get to that age, they're going to say, Dad, would you help me? I need some wisdom. I need some guidance. You know, I want to pick the right one and I don't want to make a mistake. And so we need to do our best to help them and to guide them and to guard them in these times. And it's not easy. In our situation, our boys were all in America when they found their spouse. And we prayed much, and we helped them and guided them the best we could. And the Lord was good to us, and they got all good godly spouses. But, you know, it's a situation that is difficult. But, you know, most of the time it's not at that far of a distance. So guard the situation, and please understand me. You cannot wait until they're 18 to start working to try to help them to see the need of doing all this. You've got to start when they're young. You got to keep teaching them all the way through. I mean, we taught our boys from the time they were little. Now, boys, when you get old enough to get married, you're not going to have any girlfriends until you're old enough to get married. And once you're old enough to get married, then you're only going to have girlfriends that are Christians, that love the Lord. We told them that over and over and over again as they grew up. And they weren't surprised by the time they got 17, 18, because they had heard it for years. They knew what was coming and didn't give us any fuss about it. And so it's important you prepare, because if you wait, it'll break your heart, and you don't want to do that. And so I urge you. You know, we talked right at the beginning. We need to learn from our mistakes. We need to learn from the mistakes of others. We need to learn from history so that we don't repeat it. And so tonight, as we look at this passage, we've seen how in God's reasoning, he allowed, and in Ezra's day, for the people to put away their wives to keep the purity of the nation. And I don't know how they took care of those wives after they were put away. I don't know. God doesn't explain that. But that was a unique situation. There was not a situation we can flip over and apply to us today. God says that we are to guard our situations, guard who we marry, and if a person gets saved after they're already married and they now have an unsafe spouse, then they need to stay married and work at trying to win their spouse to Christ and be faithful and loyal to them and be a good testimony before them. But we need to remember, divorce never solves a problem. It always causes more problems than it solves. And it brings heartache and sadness to the homes and the lives, and especially to the children. And so we need to just ask God to help us to do the right thing, and that we might encourage others to do the right thing. And again, I say this from the depths of my heart. There are many times, if I was just going by my emotions and someone came to talk to me about one of these situations, my emotions feel like saying, oh, yeah, just tell them, go ahead. But I can't go by my emotions. We've got to go by the scriptures. Because God's way are not always easy ways or pleasing ways. But God's way is always the best way. And we need to remember that God's way is always best. And by doing it God's way, we'll be doing it the right way.